Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Melora Fearn. Melora moved from Texas to North Carolina to become herself. Growing up a perpetual new kid, she persevered by making up stories and learned to hone that skill into writing fiction. As a recovering CPA, she now counts treasures and words discovered on her daily hikes. Turning the pages of her grandmother's Chautauqua scrapbook has opened infinite research rabbit holes and ignited her debut historical fiction. In addition to all there is with writing, she enjoys her rescue cats, gardening, birds, and losing herself in novels of all genres. And her debut novel that we're talking about today is called Whistling Women and Crowing Hens. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Melora.
Thank you. I'm very delighted to be here.
Okay. So recovering CPA, I'm also an accountant. I had an accounting practice for about 40 years, actually.
Oh, wow.
And I'm still the CFO of another company that I founded. So I'm still pretty involved in the number counting. So
yes.
Growing up, did you think about being a writer, or did you, and then you decided, well, I got to do something practical, or how did that happen for you?
No, I was an avid reader. My dad was in the Navy and we moved around quite a bit. So books and the characters in them were my close friends often before I made real friends. And so I was always a reader, but I never really thought of myself as being a writer. That was a later in life dream come true. So my dad, after he retired from the Navy, he was a accounting and information systems professor. And his rule was that we all had to go to college. We didn't have a choice, my brothers and I. And he suggested I become an accountant. And the dutiful daughter that I was at that time, I did exactly what he said, and I was good with math, and it came easily to me. So, but I worked for Big Eight back then in the 80s.
Yes.
It was the Big Eight accounting firms, Arthur Young, and then stayed with them about 6 years. They merged to be Ernst & Young.
Right.
I was on the audit side, and then I moved into computer auditing, we called it back then. And my job turned into traveling the United States teaching auditors how to use what we called desktop computers in auditing.
And now there's probably somebody teaching auditors how to use AI.
Exactly. Yeah. No, as we all experience, technology just moves at such a rapid pace, it's hard to keep up. But
I know. Yeah. I mean, I honestly... This is a joke on me. I can remember when fax machines were becoming popular, and I thought, why would I ever need that?
Yeah. Yep. Totally relate.
And then at some point, I couldn't have lived without it. And now it's like so obsolete that I can't imagine what I would ever use it for.
Right. No, it's so true. Technology just goes at leaps and bounds. And it was a challenge as a woman teaching accountants who are mostly male.
How to use computers.
How to
they
use
didn't want to, yeah.
Computer. Yeah, because a lot of them were resistant to the change and they didn't trust what I said. I had to prove myself over and over again.
Oh, I know. I remember years and years ago, I don't think it'd be like this now, but going into a Best Buy to buy another computer for my office and having difficulty getting the young male sales clerk to take me seriously. And I'm like, you know, I have bought 50 computers already. So you really should be paying attention to me.
Exactly.
I bought my first computer in 1981 or two. So,
back in the day of the floppy disks and the
compact. yes. The 5 1/4 inch floppy disk that held 98 kilobytes of data each. I still remember that. I had two disk drives, which was really something to have two. But to run a program, you often had to swap the disks in and out. And and I had to write my own accounting software. It didn't, QuickBooks didn't exist, Peachtree, none of them existed back then. Or if they did, they were so expensive, I couldn't possibly afford them. So, but the interesting thing is, I also knew how everything worked then. Like, I could take my computer apart, I could put more RAM in, I could, I understood CPM, I think was the language, that the operating system, I understood it. And now it's all like, so I'm the user, so many layers and levels above the how things are working that I couldn't do any of that anymore. So there were some advantages to it, those simpler days.
No, I agree. No, it's definitely evolved to where I don't understand a lot what's going on behind the scenes anymore.
So Whistling Women and Crowing Hens is based on your grandmother's experience on the Chautauqua circuit. How, when did you find out about this? And so why did it inspire you to write a book?
Okay. It was actually about 9 years ago now that I found it. My mom and dad lived near me, and my mom had Alzheimer's, and it had gotten to the point where he couldn't care for her anymore, so we had to move her into assisted living. In the first 10 days, the place where she was recommended that we not interact with her, that we leave her there to get acclimated, which was extremely difficult for me and my dad, especially my dad. It worked out fine, but there, and they had a lot more experience than we did. You know, we weren't real happy about it, but it, the point was to get her comfortable there. So anyways, I think his way of dealing with this extreme upheaval was to have me come and help him clean out things from their home. And so, which was good, you know, it turned out to be wonderful because I have this book, but so I was under their bed pulling things out, and I found this blue and white box. I'll never forget it. It was about, you know, as you know, big, good size box, and in my mom's handwriting, my mom was a kindergarten teacher, so her handwriting was perfect. It said Kurt's family history, and that's my mom's family. And I had never seen it, and it must have moved all over the United States with them because it was a very worn box. But inside were lots of photographs, newspaper articles, a scrapbook, and brochures, and a lot of it about their family, but a lot about her mom that I had never seen. And it turns out that my grandmother, her name's Verna Hertz Kurtz, Verna Hintz Kurtz Lambert. She was a professional musical whistler back in the 1920s, and she traveled with the Swarthmore Chautauqua Circuit. And I knew she whistled, but I had no idea that she had done this before she got married. And, you know, sadly, my grandmother died when I was 7. I couldn't ask her questions. My mom was to the point where I couldn't ask her questions. So it was really sad in a lot of ways.
And there weren't any other family members from that generation?
No, I have a few, but nobody who was willing to really share with me or who knew what to share. It was hard. So at first I thought, okay, I'm going to write my grandmother's story because I had this great scrapbook and the brochures and the newspaper articles, but I just didn't have enough information to write her story. My first idea was just to write something up for family members, especially my kids. But then I couldn't do that. I didn't have enough. And I was walking a lot in talking to my dad, and I thought, why not write a story based on her? Like, she's the spark of the main character, but it'll be different than her life because she got married and had kids and quit traveling and everything. So soon these characters were living in my head, the five women of the versatile quintet. And I know this sounds funny, but they just were demanding that I get this story written down. So before I knew it, I was trying my hand at writing. And again, I'm not a creative writer. I wasn't at the time. So my first, 40 pages were terrible. And I know all writers say their first draft is very rough, but mine was extremely rough. I figured.
So what did you do to get better? Yeah. What did you?
Well, my brain kicked in and I was like, and it was at a time where I had time to do this. I was retired from my clients. My kids had all moved out of the house. So I had time and I started taking some writing workshops, and I found one that was in North Carolina and submitted my 20 pages, got accepted. It was a great workshop, very six people, very, you know, intimate, good hands-on. And they encouraged me to keep writing and encouraged me to take some online classes. So I took some classes through Stanford's Creative Writing Continuing Education Department, which I highly recommend. They're like 9-week courses and they were so good, really good teachers that are authors, and really good class interaction and homework. I was back doing homework.
So they're online, but you're actually meeting at a certain time. And
Yeah. They're online and you meet one time a week and then you have homework, you know, both reading and writing assignments. And it was very thorough and the teachers would give great feedback and the students, you know, fellow classmates gave feedback. I learned so much through those classes, and then also continued doing some different writing workshops. And then I through the one in North Carolina, we formed a writer's critique group. And over the pandemic, we met every week online. And that was also, you know, great exercise in holding me accountable to showing up with 500 to 600 words and then hearing their feedback. So I just kept doing that. I kept writing. I kept edit, right?
Right. Yeah.
and then kept going to workshops, and I did a couple writers retreats to really, you know, focus for a good week on my writing. And, you know, through the years, I also lived my life and visited my children. And
What did your family think about your obsession now with writing this story?
I would say all three of my kids have been extremely supportive in their own ways, you know, each one uniquely different than the other. My daughters were especially supportive and encouraging and excited about it, and I'd share pieces with them a bit. And my son encouraged me in we call him a whiteboarder, and he would like come up with great ideas on how I could get better or how the story could get stronger. I would say my ex-husband was kind of thought it was silly and a joke and, you know, didn't really want to talk about it or anything. But that's okay. That was his, you know, that's just how he is.
Yeah.
My dad was very encouraging. It really drew us closer together, and he just kept saying, "You can do this. You can do this." You know, he was good, and he wanted to be my editor, which I let him a little bit, but he's very stoic, and you know, he's in the Navy. He had a whole different way of reading.
Yes. And is your mother still living?
No, my mother passed a few years ago, and my dad did just last year. Oh, so yeah, they're both gone now, which is hard. It's a weird phase of life when both your parents have passed. Because now I'm the top of the family. Yeah.
right.
I don't feel that old.
Yeah, how did that happen? How did we get there? Yeah. Of course, my mother, of course, is still doing, you know, with us and doing pretty well, and still does an occasional show with me. This past year, she really phased down. She was doing one or two a month up until this year. And but she just didn't feel like she could continue to keep up.
But what a wonderful thing that you guys have done together.
Yeah.
And you have all those memories, and that's just magical in its own way.
Yeah, it really is. I'm very, very blessed to have had that opportunity.
Yeah.
So your grandmother was a whistler. Now, my father was an amazing whistler. He could whistle anything, and I can't carry a tune whistling whatsoever. It's really a special talent, isn't it? And not that common.
No, not that common. And what made my grandmother even more unique is she has had perfect pitch. So
oh, wow.
She could whistle and sing in a perfect pitch all the time. I can even, my mom remembers her kind of scolding this fellow choir member who couldn't stay in pitch. So when people were whistling or singing out of pitch, it annoyed her.
oh my goodness. Now,
she whistled. And I mean, for people who don't know what musical whistling is, it's when someone whistles the solo, like a violin solo, but with a band and an orchestra, and you whistle the solo. And it was very popular in the turn of the century, mostly men whistlers, but it was a very popular thing that people entertained by doing these whistling songs and then also doing bird calls.
Wow.
So, and my grandmother knew over 50 bird calls, you know, the distinct different type of bird calls. So
now, do
she
you
was
remember
very
her
talented
doing,
with all
do you
that.
Remember her doing those? Did she ever do them for you when you were a child?
Yeah, I have one really memory that's, you know, becoming more real as I tell each time. But I was like seven. It was right. She died when I was eight. So it was the summer before she died. And we were in her backyard in Shillington, Pennsylvania. And they have this nice patio with a half wall brick. And she would whistle bird calls and the birds would come hopping or flying closer to us. But there was no bread or bird seed out on the wall. It was just her like conversing with them. And I was convinced she was Snow White or related to her.
of course.
So, but that's one really clear memory I have of her whistling. You know, and as a kid, you don't know to ask, well, how did you learn to whistle or anything? You know, I was just enthralled by it all. So, yeah.
Now, was your mother aware enough to know that you were writing about her mother?
No. By that time, my mom didn't know me anymore. She knew I was someone that was, you know, kind to her and she really liked. I think in her mind, I was like a college roommate or something. Mm. That Alzheimer's is just the most horrific disease ever. But we were a little bit fortunate in that my mom very rarely got angry. She was mostly in a positive way. And she was that way as a person. She was just, my dad used to joke, she was a saint and that it was really tough being married to a saint.
Yeah.
But she kind of got stuck right before they were to get married. She was kind of stuck in that time in her mind most of the time near the end there. And she would tell me, oh, I have the most exciting news today. And I'd say, you know, what is it? I called her Laura because that instead of mom. She'd say, I think Fred might propose to me today.
Oh.
And my dad was like, I'm so tired of proposing to her. And I'm like, Dad, you need to enjoy this. What if she was stuck at a time when she was really angry with you? Like, this is a good thing.
That's so sweet.
It was so sweet. So we just learned to play around. We kind of followed that guideline with patients who have dementia or memory, you know, issues, is to just play along with what the world they're in. So we would all do that to help make it the day go better for her.
So yeah. Whistling Women and Crowing Hens is set in the 1920s.
Yes.
And was this kind of the height of the, well, first of all, for not everyone's familiar with what Chautauqua was.
Oh, yeah.
So
yes.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
Okay, so at the turn of the century, it was called the Chautauqua Movement, and it was started in the late 1800s as a Sunday school training ground in upstate New York, and it's the Chautauqua Institute, and it's still thriving today. It's a kind of like an education and tourist utopia, and during the summer, they offer different weeks with different themes of education, music, lectures, readings, all kinds of really cool stuff. And it's this on this beautiful, idyllic lake. And the lake is Lake Chautauqua. And it's It comes from the Iroquois word chautauqua, which means two moccasins tied together.
Now, have you ever gone to the Chautauqua Institute?
I did. I went to the Chautauqua Institute to do research, and this was at the very beginning of my writing, and I hadn't learned yet that it's always good to email or call the librarian before you show up. Because what I found out was their library has nothing about the circuits, because the circuits weren't sanctioned by the Chautauqua Institute.
Oh, they weren't.
And so they, yeah. And so they, the Chautauqua Institute, almost the feeling I got from the librarian was that they don't even really acknowledge them, which is just shocking to me. And maybe it's just that one guy's opinion. But that's my research there was kind of a dead end. But just to continue the Chautauqua movement, what happened next was what they called daughter Chautauquas, where different cities would have their own Chautauqua and bring lecturers and highbrow music to them. And there's still a few today. There's one in Boulder, Colorado. There's one in Wichita Falls, Texas. There's one in Florida. So there's a few still today. And then what happened next were these Chautauqua circuits, and they were through enterprising men, businesses, lyceums, or universities. And at the height of the Chautauqua movement in 1924, there were over 1,000 different circuits, and they went to over 10,000 towns, and they reached 40 million people, which just blew me away. This is in 1924, and they were all over the United States. One of the most famous ones was called Red Path out in the West. And then there were quite a few that were on in the East and South side, and they went up into Canada, and they would come to a small town. They would set up for 3 to 5 days, and they would have tents usually, and the people, the townspeople would buy season pack tickets to come, and they would have a variety of different highbrow musical acts, lectures, and theater. And the whole town would basically shut down to come for these few days to get educated and entertained.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it just blew me away, because really, indirectly, all of us have been influenced by these Chautauqua circuits in some manner. And they're considered the forerunners of the TED Talks of today, because it's that same idea, spreading education, just in a different format.
Yes. And yeah. Did they have a lot of authors speaking at these?
I don't know if they had authors as much. A lot of the orators or the lecturers were talking about like philosophy or travel or, and some would do a reading, but normally not their thing, not their reading. They were reading like the Light Brigade or different dramatic readings.
Okay. Because yeah. I know that a lot of writers in like the 1800s, they didn't make much money but from selling their books. They made money by speaking tours.
Right. And maybe a lot of these lecturers were like nonfiction authors that wrote, you know, nonfiction or essays or that kind of thing.
Right.
From what, apparently, Mark Twain did a few of them. He wasn't real big on it, but he would do a few of them. So, yeah. President Roosevelt was a big proponent of it and really promoted Chautauqua circuits. He called it the fourth pillar of America, you know, education. So,
wow. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder if something like that could actually succeed today in the same, you know, traveling circuit kind of thing. The town that I live in Iowa, Fairfield, Iowa, has a Chautauqua Park. And I'm assuming that was where the Chautauqua circuit would set up when it came to town.
Yeah, because now the word Chautauqua, if you look it up online and, you know, for an online dictionary, it says traveling roadshow to promote education, you know, so Chautauqua does mean, where people gather to be educated or whatever. So, yeah, I bet it does. I bet they came there. That's so interesting.
Now, in Whistling Women and Crowing Hens, your protagonist, Birdie, is the whistler, and she also plays the trombone. Now, did your grandmother play trombone, too?
Yes, she did.
Oh, my goodness.
And I didn't know that. My uncle, my mom's brother, plays trombone. So I knew trombone was in, you know, that with him, and his son plays trombone, and my brother plays it. I'm probably one of the few people who at our wedding, he wrote a trio of Holy, Holy, Holy for trombones, and they played at our wedding.
Oh, my goodness. Now, <'Cause you> know, the funny thing is that, you know, when I was a kid and we're ready to start band in fourth grade, and I, because of our circumstances, I had to choose an instrument that that the school would provide for free. And we owned a trumpet, but my brother already claimed that, so I couldn't do trumpet. I had to do something that the school would give. So I had basically a choice of the big instruments, because the schools didn't expect families to go out and buy this.
Yeah.
So I played baritone horn, which sits with the trombones in the band and often plays the same parts as the trombones. And I thought trombone was really interesting, but it was considered a male instrument. It was very unusual. This would have been in the 60s and 70s to find a female trombone player.
Right. And in the 20s, it was extremely unusual.
I bet.
And I couldn't find how my grandmother, like how and why she had the trombone, but I have this beautiful photograph of her standing in this nice dress holding her trombone.
Oh, my goodness. That's amazing.
Yeah. I tried to take as much from my grandmother, you know, which I knew was true, like from the brochures, like the instruments of the versatile quintet. I've had musicians say, Laura, that doesn't make sense. It's a trombone, a banjo, a harp, a violin, and a piano. And I'm like, I know, it doesn't make any sense. But that's what they were. That's how they were listed in the brochures, you know, for the Chautauqua circuit. So I stayed true to everything that I could, you know, either research through different libraries and different things, or I could research through my grandmother. I tried to stay true to all of that. Like all the cities that they travel to in my book are based on a schedule that I found at the Swarthmore Library, Swarthmore College Library, that was the actual circuit's travel schedule. So
you were able to find other information about that tour that your grandmother was actually on.
Yes. Yeah. I went to the Swarthmore College Library and they had like literally boxes of notes, train schedules, rules, you know, all kinds of really cool stuff. I spent a good day and a half there really researching.
So like the rule against the talent fraternizing, was that a real thing?
Yeah. That was the real thing. Yep, yeah. From a little rule book. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Yep. So it seemed like in Whistling Women and Crowing Hens that when Chautauqua came to a town, it would stay several days, but the girls, the versatile quintet, didn't stay through the whole time. That they only appeared at the very beginning and then they would go on to the next town.
Yep. And that's how I got all of that from that Swarthmore College Library. The Swarthmore circuit had three, sometimes four different circuits running the same summer. And so it was, for whatever reason, they had like opening day talent would move to be at the beginning of each circuit. And then, you know, the lecturer would move with them. And the theater was always the last day or two and they would follow through. So yeah, it was fairly common to have the talent travel from, you know, a lot more, not stay, you know, bring in different talent the second night and different talent the third night.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So they didn't all travel together as a group.
No.
And so possibly there was some overlap, like they could be starting the next one before the group was finished with the last one.
Almost always
oh, wow.
The way the schedule worked. Yeah. And it was, to me, it was very complicated and it didn't make sense. And you know how when you do research for especially historical fiction, I tried not to info dump in my novel too much, but I did want to get across how the schedule was, you know, they were always moving. They were in a different place each night. And so it's a balancing act of not trying to just dump all this information in, but, you know, make it part of the story. And so I kind of had Birdie figuring it out.
Yeah. And they did actually go to Canada as well.
Right. They did go to Canada. That's why I kept put that in there. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. What does the title, I mean, Whistling Women, of course, would be, you know, yes, she was a whistling woman, but Whistling Women and Crowing Hens. Why, what does that mean?
Well, so known as an American folk saying, whistling women and crowing hens never come to a good end. But I found out since my book's come out, I've met some people and I've done more research, and I found out that it actually is from the 1700s, and there's all different ways of saying it. But in Ireland, it was a popular saying. And the whole point of the saying was to quiet women's voices. You know, women, it's not proper for women to speak out, let alone whistle.
Yeah.
And same with a crowing hen. Nobody wants a crowing hen. So they, like one of them, you know, the crowing hen gets their neck wrung.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I didn't find that title till near my first manuscript was, first draft was written, and I was really editing it. And I was with one of my friends, a writing friends, and we had met her neighbor, and her neighbor is here in North Carolina and very true, genuine Southern woman. And as soon as I told her my book was about a woman who whistles, she spouted off that saying in her beautiful North Carolina drawl. And I was like, okay, I've got to work that in my novel, and I've got to have that be the title. And then the more, you know, of course I researched, I love research, and I've, as I say, I tumble down many rabbit holes. But once I found out all the history behind that saying, I thought this has got to be the title of my book, and because it just is so Birdie's story, where she starts out not really having her own voice, and by the end she finds her voice. So, yeah.
So, in terms of that, where she was, you know, living with her sister, who really, and her sister's husband, and her sister was really very controlling, and it was very hard for her to break free, or even to be able to go to do what she wanted to do with her life at all. Is that something that you've based on your grandmother, or was that more fictional?
No, that was much more fictional. So my grandmother was the youngest of eight, a very matriarchal family and very strong powered women. And her sisters really encouraged her to travel and And she even went to Oberlin College for 1 year for in ornithology, learning more about whistling. So her sisters were very encouraging of her. So I didn't have that in there until after pretty much my first draft in my writer's critique group. They were like, Laura, why would Birdie want to leave if her sisters are so encouraging her? Like, why would she want to do this? Mm. And so I took a course on writing the first chapter at Stanford, and I learned that it was really important in the whole structuring a story of the hero's journey, which I kind of followed, is they need to have a reason to leave. And
right.
Their normal can't be so wonderful that they don't want to leave it, you know, that.
Right, right.
And so, that's where I really went away from my grandmother's story and did, you know, I created this older sister who was kind of overbearing and not only overbearing, but old fashioned, because all my research in the 1920s, it was such a fascinating time for women because there were so many changes going on. And when we read novels or see on TV, we mostly see the flappers and the, you know, the gin and the jazz joints. And for most women from smaller towns in the rural places, that wasn't really the case. They weren't flappers. But they were embracing a lot of the changes and expressing themselves, you know, through different freedoms of cutting their hair or their what they wore and then what they did. You know, they definitely got more power in the 20s. So I wanted to kind of play the old fashioned Victorian morals against the newer modern of the 20s. So
right,
that's how I did it
right.
through the two sisters.
Yeah, just the idea of cutting your hair being a big deal.
Yeah, I know.
I know.
It's hard to imagine now.
It is. And how restricted most women were, and how few the opportunities to actually make a living as a woman.
Right. No, and that very true. And I found most women didn't do it. It took quite a while, in past the 30s and then into World War II, that women were really doing more career changes. But women in theater had a little more leniency, so that was a good vehicle to make it true. Because I wanted it to be as authentic as as possible, but to also show that change and show a woman being able to be more free and get her own voice. Yeah.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Melora Fern, author of Whistling Women and Crowing Hens. Now, was the Whistling School in California, was that a real place?
Yeah. So the only real person in my book is Agnes Woodward. And in 1910, she was in L.A., Los Angeles, and she started this whistling school for women. It was first called the California Whistling School, but by the 1920s, it was Agnes Woodward Whistling School. And she wrote a textbook called The Art of Whistling. And I have my grandmother's copy of it. It's such a cool book because she has musical score in there, but she devised this whole way of writing bird twills and trills and octave changes. She writes them with little symbols in the music score. It's just fascinating what Agnes Woodward did. But she was a woman well before her time. She started this school, and she was a big proponent of helping women be independently financially supportive, and they learned either by performing or teaching or whatever. And one little anecdote about her, the whistlers who performed at Walt Disney for their Mickey Mouse whistling or Snow White or Bambi were all women whistlers from her school.
Oh!
Yeah. And they weren't recognized back then, in any of the credits, but now they're starting to be acknowledged, and they're all of them were from her school. So, I just thought it was fascinating.
Wow.
And she had this correspondence school, and I still haven't been able to figure out how. Like, my grandmother lived in Pennsylvania, and as far as I know, she never traveled to California, but she had a letter of acceptance to the correspondence whistling school. She has the textbook, and it has her notes and, everything in it. And then she has a certificate that she passed it. But I don't know exactly how someone in the 1920s accomplished a whistling school, a correspondence whistling school from Pennsylvania to California. I don't know. So I kind of made up that they whistled over the phone or something.
Right. So I'm assuming that school doesn't still exist.
No, I actually went to LA this summer. I had the most unique opportunity. I went to the International Musical Whistling Competition in Los Angeles. So it was a big deal for many, many years, these whistling competitions, but it's kind of dwindled down now. But there were over 80 whistlers there, and they were from all over the world, Japan, South Korea, Venezuela.
Wow.
All doing musical whistling, different levels of competition. But while I was there, I set up appointments with different libraries to do research on Agnes Woodward, but I've hit a dead end so far. For my next book, I kind of want to continue a little bit of the story, but not have Birdie be the main character, have a different main character and have Agnes Woodward figure in somehow. I'm still in the creative stages in my mind. I haven't put a lot of pen to paper yet.
Okay. Well, Melora, why don't you read a little bit from Whistling Women and Crowing Hens?
Okay, I'd be happy to. I'm going to read from the beginning because I think it kind of sets the stage. Here we go. Whistling Women and Crowing Hens. Whistling women and crowing hens always come to some bad ends, an American folk saying. Girls who whistle and hens that crow will make their way wherever they go. Agnes Woodward. Chapter 1, Westchester, Pennsylvania, March 1924. Bertie Stauffer emptied the valve by blowing spit onto a rag she had tossed on the floor. She worked the trombone slide back and forth as her sister Lydia took one more bow. The stuffy room filled with polite applause that evolved into the comfortable sound of female chatter. Lydia winced. Bertha, I've told you to do that in the privacy of our home. She swiped the pages of sheet music from their ornate music stand, then placed them in her satchel. Yes, ma'am. Bertie tucked the rag and offensive instrument snug in its worn case. For the past 5 years, Bertie and Lydia had entertained at local ladies' luncheons because, as Lydia often said, it was their duty to bring sophisticated culture to their community. Bertie went along with Lydia's creative crusade, just like she did with most of Lydia's ideas. It made everyone's life easier. She snapped the trombone case shut and gave herself a little hug before she faced Lydia. You played Sousa perfectly today, Lydia beamed. At last, you're ready to perform with me at the Pocono Manor Resort. Bertie had Lydia's Shakespearean monologues memorized. She could mimic each dramatic pause and theatrical gesture. Bertie surveyed today's audience, noting the many yawns and nodding heads. She questioned if she wanted to impress the Westchester Auxiliary Women's Club crowd like her older sister. Pardon me, an elegant woman tapped their music stand with her folded fan. Ah, Miss Wilcox, Lydia extended her gloved hand, nudging Bertie aside. We enjoyed your little show. She motioned to the slender young woman who stood beside her. I'd like you to meet my niece, Helen Wilcox. First in her class at Curtis Music Institute. She's quite impressed with your sister's talent. A slight frown passed before Lydia's face turned broad, then fixed, as if performing again. Is that so? Helen stepped around Lydia to extend her hand in front of Bertie. Delighted to meet you. Bertie wasn't sure what to do, so she shook Helen's hand once while she admired Helen's audacity, plus her unique brooch with two intertwined swallows. Join me for some punch? Ellen's emerald drop-waist dress and traveling cloak matched her lively eyes. She looked as if she had stepped out of one of Bertie's taboo Vogue magazines. Oh, to own a modern outfit like that. Thank you, but Bertha has obligations with me. Lydia placed a hand on Bertie's shoulder. I do. However, Bertie faced her sister. I'll only be gone a few minutes and will return with some punch for you as well. Bertie's stomach fluttered. Most days she accepted doting on Lydia, especially considering her older sister's delicate condition. What made her challenge Lydia today? Be quick about it. Lydia removed her hand from Bertie as she narrowed her eyes at Helen for a brief second. There are several ladies you need to greet. Helen eased them away from the growing cluster of elderly women surrounding Lydia. She reminded Bertie of someone but couldn't place who. I believe your sister will be well attended. Helen ladled pink punch into two crystal cups, then handed one to Bertie. She appears to enjoy the limelight. Helen's laugh resonated like glass wind chimes. Bertie sipped the maraschino cherry punch, admiring Helen's Marcel-waved haircut. Helen must suspect Bertie was stuck in the medieval times with her long hair twisted up in a low bun. What about you? Do you like the stage as well? Helen popped an entire deviled egg into her mouth. I guess I do. Bertie nodded towards Lydia. I'm obviously not as talented as my sister. I think you're better. Helen shielded her mouth with her hand. I adored your arrangement of Sousa's The White Rose. Who taught you the trombone? My Uncle Bert. He thought it would be hilarious if a young lady played trombone. Bertie tucked one worn button-up boot behind the other as she glanced down at Helen's T-strapped pumps. little did he realize I'd take to it so. You're a natural on the stage. Bertie spooned salted almonds into her palm from a pedestal dish. Several tumbled on the lace tablecloth. Where's your music institute? Philly, I'm studying classical piano and composition. Helen scooped the wayward almonds into her hand and then ate them. Bertie almost choked. Helen had manners that would make Lydia gasp. That must be exciting. I adore Philadelphia, Bertie said after she got her voice back. Philly is where I was raised, but I've got bigger plans for this summer. Helen's eyes widened a bit. I'm auditioning for the Westvale Chautauqua Circuit next week. Glory be! Westvale Chautauqua was the most discriminating of all traveling circuits. You should audition too. Me? It felt like an almond had lodged in Bertie's throat. To be on the level, I've seen several of your variety act performances. Oh, Bertie tilted her head. I asked my aunt to introduce us so I could encourage you to audition. Helen pushed some hair behind her right ear. Traveling with the Chautauqua Circuit could be just the ticket Bertie needed to leave Lydia and Gerald's home. Recently, they had become infatuated with introducing her to every single man they knew, each dreadful bachelor a bigger adult than the one before. Bertie wished for something other than marriage to a stuffy Pennsylvania businessman and performing at ladies' luncheons. She finished her punch. Lydia wouldn't like the idea of auditioning. I doubt if I'm qualified to perform with Westdale. A pretty blonde who has mastered the trombone would be quite the cat's meow. Do you have other musical talents? Bertie hadn't been called pretty for years. I also perform monologues, play piano, sing, and... What? Bertie lowered her voice. Imitate bird songs and calls. I know many. I knew it, Helen clapped once. You are uniquely talented. Let's hear one. I can't hear. Bertie shuddered at the thought. My sister would faint from embarrassment. Let's go outside then.
And that was Melora Fern reading from Whistling Women and Crowing Hens. So you talked a little bit about how you started writing and realized that you weren't very good at it to begin with, and how you learned and got better. How did you know when you were ready to start submitting?
Oh, great question, because I think that's, you know, you always think you're ready before you're ready. But I participated in a manuscript workshop with three other authors and an editor. And so I'd been through a very vigorous editing process because both the editor gave their comments and then all the participants did. And so it was after that I felt like I was getting close to being ready. So I went to Women's Fiction Writers Association conference in Chicago, and I tried pitching to a few agents. And beforehand, I took a course on pitching, all that, because that's how I work. The accountant in me is always there, and I had a spreadsheet of all the agents and all that. So, but through that exercise, you know, they all asked for more pages, which was wonderful. People loved the premise, but I never heard from any of them, not a peep.
Oh.
And so I thought, okay, you know, I still was new to this whole thing. So I thought maybe I need to rework it more. So I sent my manuscript out to about six beta readers, a couple writers, and then a couple people who were more readers than writers, and took it through another editing process. And then also in the meantime, honed my query and my pitching. So then I felt like it was ready, and I just hit it hard, sending out many queries to agents. And I did a couple online pitching things. Again, didn't hear much from agents, or if I did hear, it was a rejection. But I just kept doing it for about almost 10 months. And by that time, I hadn't heard from anyone. And I was 64 years old. And I thought, I am going to get this book published you know, I need to step back. What, you know, why is it so important to have an agent? I think I'm going to approach small presses. So I took a couple weeks to really think it through, talk it over with my writing critique group. I mean, there would not be a novel without my writer's critique group. I started querying small presses and got much stronger. I got, you know, two offers within a few weeks. And I mean, I was running through my house. I was so excited. Wow. So yeah, I went with the small press route, and I'm so happy I did. Sibline Press has been very supportive. It's a small press owned by women. One of the women who owns it is the artist, and I think the cover is just amazing. I love everything about the cover, and that my editor was really strong. So, you know, here I am now. I now was 65 when I when it finally came out into the world. So,
hey, congratulations! Congratulations! Thank you. And yeah, it was published in May of 2025.
Right.
And what kind of response have you gotten?
Oh, I've had such a wonderful experience with it. I had two book launches, one here in North Carolina and one in Texas, and just overwhelmingly positive responses and people from my past who came to support me. And since then I've done, you know, bookstore events, and my favorite thing to do is go to book clubs.
In person or on Zoom?
Well, I'll do both. I've done both. You know, in person is great. And if I happen to be in your area, I would love to try to coordinate that. But there is nothing like talking about your book with people who have read it. It's just, you know, like this, you know, it's just so fun. And I love hearing what they liked and what they didn't like. Because, you know, definitely through this whole process, I've developed very thick skin. I haven't had one bad critique. I've had, you know, definitely constructive criticism. But I think that's what makes me a better writer, and I can always be better. So I just firmly believe in hearing what people think, and, you know, what they didn't like is just as important as the accolades. So, and then the latest thing that I've been doing is I taught a class at our local library on taking family stories and making it fiction. Oh. And it was so much fun. So I'm hoping to do more of that. And it was, you know, a free class at the library. I'm not trying to make any money off of it, but it was just so fun to have the light go on in people's eyes. And I love sharing what I've learned. You know, why not? If someone else can do it quicker and better, that's great.
I'd like to take that course.
Yeah, because don't you? I just firmly believe every person has family stories.
Oh, yes.
And for me, using fiction as a vehicle to still get the family story out there, but give you so much more creative freedom, it's been wonderful. So yeah. I'm hoping other people can do the same thing.
I have a treasure trove of family documents. It's when you're talking about finding your grandmother's scrapbook under the bed. Actually, this year, now, first of all, I have a treasure trove. I have things going back to the 1800s. I have letters from soldiers in the Civil War. My grandmother was a pack rat. She kept everything. And a lot of it has ended up with me. My mother also has a lot. But this year, I was looking under my mother's bed for a financial document that she thought was under there. And I found this box that I had never seen before that had pictures of my mother in college that I had never seen before. My sister had never seen before. My mother did not share these with us. And it was... There were five, like, almost portrait studio or professional photographs of her over about a five-month period going to different dances, different events.
Oh, wow.
She was at the University of Iowa, and with a different date every time, except there was one that showed up twice. And this would,
wow.
I know, and she was gorgeous, and it was, and then also, there was some newspaper clippings, and I knew that she had been in an opera in college, and so there were photographs of her in the newspaper in this opera, and that I'd never seen before. And there was, she was also on the student union board. And so there were some articles about that. And,
yeah.
And she was sitting next to this man in one of them. And I was asking her about him because it was, what was his name? It was like, I think maybe, I can't remember the first name, but it was a very Greek name. And and the last name was Papa John, which is a very kind of famous name in Iowa because this man's brother was an extremely successful financier, and like there's parks and things named after him in Des Moines. And I had no idea that she was friends with his brother, and she had no idea that they, what had ever happened to them, you know, afterwards. And, and it was really fun to find that.
I know. And I mean, just think about those pictures. They, you know, people say a picture is worth a thousand words, but there's so much story right there in those pictures of like, why was she with different dates? Why different dances? Was she entering contest? Like, it's just,
I know. And it would have been right before, or right about the time that she met my dad was when this happened, or right before she met my dad, who was, and that's a whole nother story because they were introduced by someone that she met at the University of Iowa. My dad was at boot camp somewhere, and he had recently, he was in ROTC and had graduated from college and gone off to the Army. And my mother started writing him, and they got engaged after only having actually met once in person.
Wow.
But they'd been writing these letters.
Thank you so much. That sounds similar to my mom and dad. He was Navy ROTC, and he went to flight school, and he met my mom, and they wrote letters, and they were only dated really 6 or 7 months, and they were engaged. Because I think that's what you did. One, you got to know someone through the letters, and two, you got married quick.
So anyway, it's been great fun talking to you. We're out of time.
This has been a delight.
Yeah. And I'm glad to hear that the story of Birdie may continue. And we always close with a quote. And the one that I found today about Chautauqua came from Frank B. Bohn, B-O-H-N, a socialist journalist and speaker, who said, "He who does not know Chautauqua does not know America."
There you go.
Yeah,
it was so influential.
And so if you want to learn a little bit about Chautauqua, you can read Whistling Women and Crowing Hens.
Yes.
Thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.